Working our way through the opening chapters of Genesis, seeking out those passages that cause people to doubt the reliability and accuracy of Genesis as the Word of God, but also seeking out those opportunities to establish new evidences that the Bible indeed is the error-free Word of God, not just for faith and practice, but science, history, all disciplines. And now I've moved out of the fifth chapter into the sixth chapter of Genesis, moving right along, and kind of how we made the transition from Genesis 5 to Genesis 6 is to indicate that we have a lot of new evidence for the birth date of Adam. And what we're seeing in Genesis chapter 6 is, need to move it over a little bit, about how's that? As we pointed out before, what's amazing is just how consistent all these independent new methods are for giving us the date when Adam and Eve were created, and also how particularly in the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA data, we have evidence that human beings are specially created. They're not evolved. The descent of man theory has now been overthrown, at least for human beings. And there's new evidences indicating that's happening for the larger primates as well. Okay, this last one, land bridges, is something we'll cover when we hit Genesis chapter 11. What we see in Genesis chapter 6 are some new evidences for the early history of humanity that the Bible speaks about. The land bridges will be that event which allowed human beings to spread from Mesopotamia into all the continents of the world. How these bridges form for just a relatively brief period of time, and how this is consistent with what we see in Genesis 9, 10, and 11. What we began to discuss last time is the new scientific evidence we have for the shortening of human lifespans from 900 years down to less than 120. And I'm going to get to that, but what I want to share with you is something that's really brand new. Just got published, okay? We always like to try to tell you stuff that's just happened in the last week or two. Well, this is one of them, and it's something we'll need to look at when we get into the 11th chapter of Genesis, namely that scientists have been looking at three orbital cycles. And I'll get into the physics of the orbit in layman's language in a minute. But the bottom line is that these three orbital cycles show them all coming together in an amazingly stable fashion and favorable fashion for human habitation in the last 9,000 years, with an estimate that we got maybe another 1,000 years left. And as a couple of the researchers who are responsible for this study indicated, it's possible this is the only 10,000-year window in the orbital history of the Earth. Well, I think I'm going in and out now. Are you still hearing me? I can hear it going from one speaker to the other. Sounds stereo, right? Anyway, what I'm going to do is go to the blackboard and kind of diagram this stuff for you, because I was explaining this to Kathy on the way over. She says, don't use the words eccentricity, obliquity, or precession, okay? So I'm not going to use those words. What I'm going to do is diagram them for you, and then you'll get an idea of just how rare this little window of time is. And, of course, what I'm speaking about is this is that window of time that God chose for human beings to populate the whole planet. Only 11,000 years ago was North America visited for the first time by human beings. And incidentally, of all the continents on planet Earth, North America is the one most sensitive to these orbital instabilities. And so isn't it interesting that God kind of held back human habitation in North America until we got into this ideal window? And maybe this has some kind of impact on your interpretation of the end times. You know, given that the window is going to close shortly, wouldn't it be a good idea for God to wrap up human history within that period of time so that we have the blessing of this ideal, stable, worldwide climate in which to spread the Great Commission? So all you missionaries here in the audience, keep in mind God's only giving us a few more hundreds of years to wrap up the job. I think we can do it in a few decades, but to of the climate, the time for spreading the gospel really is now. Okay, let me see if this will reach at the blackboard. No, Greg, this is not the material published in the thesis. It's in three research papers that have just been published in the last few weeks. So it's in addition to what we were talking about in the thesis. Yes. Can I move the blackboard forward? Yeah, I think we can. There we go. Thank you, Roger. All right. We'll deal with procession first. You got the earth, and well, let's deal with obliquity. Obliquity is simply the tilt of the earth's rotation axis relative to the solar system plane. And this is why in the summertime, in the extreme northern latitudes, the sun's up 24 hours a day, whereas in the south, it's down 24 hours a day. And this 23.5-degree tilt or obliquity in the Earth's rotation axis allows the maximum surface area of the planet to have an ameliorated climate. If it were 0 degrees, there'd be far fewer square miles on planet Earth in which human habitation would be possible. Likewise, if it was 45 degrees, there'd be far fewer square miles that would be habitable. 23.5 degrees, you get the maximum surface area of the planet in which you can have the ideal human habitation. Now then, this typically the obliquity of a planet, the tilt of its rotation axis, varies like this. That's what the other solar system bodies experience. It swings around. Well, for example, at Uranus, it's 98 degrees. It's tilted down here. Okay? And so you look at the other solar system bodies, their obliquity varies from 0 to 98. And it varies with time. So Uranus doesn't always have it at 98 degrees. It'll be flipping around over the last several billion years. Yes. I wonder if that got on tape. But how much does it typically flip for a planet? It can flip 40, 50, 60 degrees. Now then, it doesn't flip like that over thousands of years. We're talking billions of years. So say over the course of the 4 billion year history of the solar system, you'll get these wide flips. Now, which ones flip like Mars has a rather unstable obliquity. So it flips a little more rapidly and dramatically than the other solar system. It's a smaller planet, and it's right next to the big boys, Uranus and Saturn. You know, a little bit of input?
Well, just to verify what you're saying, the guy came to JPL and gave a talk on this very subject, how over the theoretical computer studies, over a long period of time, you get this complete flipping.
Right. Yeah, it really does happen. And that's a relatively new discovery because when I was a graduate student in astronomy, they taught us that the obliquity of all the planets was stable. You know, it changed. And that the obliquity was set when the solar system formed. We now know that's not true. The obliquity is set when the solar system forms, but then there's the dynamics of the solar system bodies that will kick it back and forth by tens of degrees over a few billion years. The one exception to all of that is planet Earth. Earth is not subject to these wild swings in the obliquity because it's got this gigantic moon orbiting not too far away from it. And what the moon does is it stabilizes the obliquity. Now then, what this new research indicates is that it does it in a very remarkable way, but we still have small variations. So the Earth's obliquity would vary like 23.5 degrees plus or minus 1 degree. So So that 1 degree turns out to be important. So just a 1 degree flip in the obliquity will induce significant climatic effects, especially in the high latitudes. So like you in the United States, Canada, Europe, where a lot of people live, would be affected by this 1 degree change in the obliquity. Okay, so this is one variation that has been studied. That's the obliquity. The other one is the precession. You say, well, what's precession? Okay, it stays at 23.5 degrees plus or minus at 1 degree, but what's going on is that this thing spins like a top. It precesses like a top. I don't know, these toys aren't as common as they used to be, but when I was a little kid, a lot of our neighbors had these little spinning tops, and you pull this string and you get the top to spin, and it'll spin straight up for a while, not very long, and then suddenly it'll tilt over like this, and that explains why a lot of the planets are not at zero. You tend to get this flip. And then when it gets flipped over, it tends to be stable for a while. It will keep that tilt, but then it will precess like this. You'll watch the top spin around like this. Okay? Well, all the planets do this. And in the case of the Earth, we have a precession cycle of 26,000 years, which is why you have to be extremely skeptical about astrology. You know, one of my pet peeves about astrologers is they don't correct for precession. So they're still stuck back 2,000 years ago, and they're saying that the sign in the sky that marks the beginning of the zodiac and the first part of spring is Aries. Well, they're off by about a sign and a half these days. It's not Aries. It's moving from Pisces into Aquarius. So whatever your sign is, it's wrong, okay? It's wrong by at least one or two signs because there's been no correction for precession. All right, well...
subject of a popular song.
Well, right. And I was, you know, growing up during those years when that song was popular. And even then, I said, well, wait a minute. They're talking about this being the dawning of the age of Aquarius. My precession calculations tell me we got another 200 years to go. So we're not in Aquarius yet. So, but well, regardless, the Earth does precess as it spins over a 26,000-year cycle, which is, by the way, here's another interesting effect. Right now, the North Star is the best polar star that will ever exist in the history of the Earth. Over 4.5 billion years, we got the best North Star. The next North Star is going to be Vega. So wait a few thousand years, and it'll be Vega instead of the North Star. But isn't it interesting that towards the end of the 20th century, we get blessed with the best North Star? All right, that's a little bit of extra just thrown in there. Okay. Now, this 26,000-year precession cycle also varies. It's not exactly 26,000 years over billions of years. It varies by a little bit, not by much. And this is the hardest one to measure. We're talking, you know, maybe plus or minus 500 years. But what this precession does is it has a small impact on the climate. Okay? Now, then, there's another one, which is called the eccentricity. And this would have the... most significant effect. Okay, what's the eccentricity? Well, you all probably remember your high school history of science classes where they taught you about Ptolemaic astronomy, which said that the planets orbit about the sun in these circles, and they couldn't get it quite to work, so they said circles upon circles. So they had these little epicircles, and what it was all trying to do was approximate the fact that the planets do not orbit about stars in circles. They orbit in ellipses. By the way, Ptolemy knew perfectly well that the circle theory was wrong. The reason he instituted it is he didn't have the mathematics to deal with elliptical orbits. He lacked algebra, so he did the best thing he could. He used circles upon circles upon circles to get a good calculation as to when the different planets, where the different planets would be in the sky at different times. So he knew the right answer all along, but he lacked the mathematics. But it was Newton who laid down the mathematics of elliptical orbits. And so you have... a star here, and it'll have a planet, and the planet will orbit like this rather than in a perfect circle. Now, what the discovery of extrasolar planets has taught us is that what's typical is for planets to have highly elliptic orbits. Now, if you look on our own solar system, only two planets have highly elliptical orbits. It'd be Mercury and Pluto. And by highly elliptic, they mean where this length is much longer than that length, okay? Now, the Earth, like Venus, has a very low eccentricity, which is a good thing, because when you're out here, it's going to be cold, and when you're here, it's going to be hot. And with the Earth, there's only about a 1% difference between here and here, and so actually, it has a lesser effect on disturbing our climate than does the obliquity. And what's really good is in the northern hemisphere, the two effects cancel off. So if you're living in the northern hemisphere, we're out here in the summertime, and we're here in the wintertime. And so it really helps to ameliorate our climate. Now, if you're in the southern tip of South America, then the two effects work together. And so that explains why it's so miserable at the south tip of South America, because during the wintertime, you're out here. So it makes for really cold winters and hotter summers, yes.
I think the summer and winter were on opposite sides of the weather.
Okay, now what governs summer and winter is this tilt up here, okay? Oh, down here.
Yeah.
Sorry. You're right. Let's do it right. All right. There we go. That's better. Okay. So this is summer if you're in the south hemisphere, and winter if you're in the south hemisphere. But if you're in the northern hemisphere, you're here in the winter and there in the summer. And so, that makes life pleasant when you're living in the northern hemisphere, life a little less pleasant if you're living in the southern hemisphere. We've commented before, when you look at a globe, there's very little landmass at high southern latitudes, almost none. Whereas if you look in the northern hemisphere, there's a huge amount of landmass in the high northern latitudes. Is that an accident? I mean, this is literally what permits maximum human habitation, an ideal human habitation on our planet. Okay, but this eccentricity varies. Okay? Now, what's the cycle for the eccentricity? It's 100,000 years, about 101,000 years. Okay, that this eccentricity for planet Earth varies. This is 41,000 years. So you've got these three cycles, a 101,000-year cycle, a 41,000-year cycle, and a 26,000-year cycle. And now I think it's easy to see how amazing it is that you get these three working together so that you get this most ideal, stable climate period existing for the past 9,000 years. Yeah, Kathy.
What happens every 101,000?
Okay, the eccentricity of the Earth, I'm trying to remember the exact figure. I think it's 0.013. Okay, maybe you know the figure. I think it's 0.1013, but it varies a little bit. Okay, by something like that. I'm not too sure about this figure. It could be one or two. Okay, it's the variation from, say, 0.011 to 0.015 that varies over a period of 101,000 years. Gotcha? Okay. All right. It varies. Yeah. The eccentricity. Okay. In other words, yeah, it becomes a little more eccentric or a little less eccentric, and the variation from here to here takes place over 101,000 years. Okay. What this 0.013 is measuring is how much bigger this is than that. All right. So it's a little, it's 1.3% farther from the sun in the winter than it is in the summer. Yes. You can't see when I'm standing in front of the board. All right. Well, let's see. I could probably angle it to be, yeah, it's actually angled in favor of this side, so I've been biasing this side. We'll, no, don't put it too far back, because then we, then the screen starts getting in the way. How's that? I should have put this all on overheads, but I didn't have time this week. There were some other things going on. So, yeah, I could, but I'm not. I'm actually better with chalk than I am with one of those pens. So, because I do have some blanks there, but thank you. Okay. So this 41,000 year, what's varying is this 1 degree, okay? So it goes from, say, 22.5 to 24.5 over a period of 41,000 years. And the precession goes from 25,500 to 26,500. And the cycle on this, I've forgotten the cycle. I was just reading it last night, but I forget over what period of time the precession varies. It's a longer period of time than these two. So the precession, so it's this one cycles over 101,000 years, 41,000 years. This is considerably longer than these two, something on the order of millions. I just forget the exact number. But what's coming out of this research study is that typically these three cycles work together to cause instabilities such that you get rather wild swings in the climate. The one exception to that is the past 9,000 years. And this explains why ice ages typically last a long time. For example, the ice age just previous to 10,000 years ago lasted tens of thousands of years. And so it was rather difficult. I mean, as you read the Bible, things really begin to kick into gear after the flood. Well, the climatic stability will allow things to really kick into gear in terms of human population growth and technology. Whereas before that, you'd have these things working to generate small instabilities. Incidentally, all of these things are small enough that it makes human life possible throughout the entire era. But in terms of making things ideal for human existence, only the last 9,000 years. How much longer will it last? Well, we've probably got another 1,000 years or less. Okay, there's a question somewhere over here. Yes. Yeah, they're coming out of computer models, although, and what's making it possible is NASA research enables us not only to measure the precession very accurately, the obliquity and the eccentricity, but now we can start measuring the variations of these three factors over time. And so it's the variations of these cycles which is instituting this new research. Yes. Yeah, it comes out of the computer models, but the computer models are based on very accurate measurements of the orbits of the solar system bodies and the rotations. Yes. Yeah, the Lord has to come any day now. Of course, did you hear her line of reasoning? If there's only 1,000 years left, and we got the Lord reigning for 1,000 years on planet Earth, she's taking a premillennial perspective of end times prophecy. which probably is a majority view in this audience. So what she's saying is in the 1,000 years it better start fairly quickly because the instability will be over. Okay, just a cautionary note on that. It's about 1,000 years more. That's not an accurate number. And by the way, I'm in concordance with her because, you know, as you see the Great Commission being fulfilled, it's taking place rapidly. You know, we've gone from 2% of the world's population being classified as evangelical who are committed to fulfilling the Great Commission, this is Ralph Winter's figures, to about 14% today. So that's a very dramatic increase, unprecedented in human history, which gives me at least hope that it could be done within a few decades. As Ralph Winter says, evangelicals today have the money, the technology, and the personnel to finish the Great Commission in 5 years. But what that would take is for all evangelicals to increase their support of the fulfillment of the Great Commission by a factor of 10. And that's within our financial means. The problem is when you look at giving records of evangelicals for the fulfillment of the Great Commission, what you discover is a lot of people that give 10 to 15% and everybody else giving close to zero. And it's not reasonable for the people giving 10 to 15% to increase their giving by a factor of 10. I mean, that's not going to happen. Not with the IRS around. That's not going to happen. Not if you got to put food on the table. That's not going to happen. So just to put a little bit of a damper on Ralph Winter's estimates, in order to fulfill the Great Commission, evangelicals are going to have to recruit a lot more of their peers to the task of fulfilling the Great Commission. And that's where we should be throwing our efforts at this point. But I see nothing wrong with the Lord returning in 20 or 30 years. Now, that to me is completely within reason that it could happen. And incidentally, God's always got a little extra tool for encouraging more evangelicals to support the fulfillment of the Great Commission. If you want to know what that is, read the book of Acts. When things were going a little bit slow, God had a special way of kicking things into high gear. Okay, read the book of Acts, but you're not going to like it. All right. Okay, there's a hand here, right.
Oh, I'm just going to bring up the question that your computer model. You can also ask the question, does he use any observation to verify the results?
Like
you have ancient Chinese observations.
Yes. Well, yeah, I think that's good that you raise that point, because sometimes when you say something's based on computer models, a lot of people say, well, then we can ignore it. It may not be real. There are computer models and there are computer models. Some computer models, you get a conclusion, for example, global warming, where the plus or minuses are rather large. Why? Because they don't have numbers for everything they want to have numbers for. In this case, the computer modeling, I forget who raised the question, you did, is far superior to that because we do have the numbers. So there really aren't any unknowns sitting out there that could disturb these conclusions. Because we're dealing with rather simple objects. Planets orbiting about stars, satellites orbiting about planets, it's point source physics, which is something that we can measure relatively easily and do calculations to very high precision. In fact, what's remarkable about these computer models, we can tell you where Venus was 250 million years ago. That's how good the data is. So these kinds of conclusions are rather hard and fast. Yes. Well, I was going to talk about dating the time when human lifespan went from 900 years down to a max of 120. Ideally, I should be bringing this up when we get past the flood sequence and talk about the spread of humanity over planet Earth, because that's what this data, I think, really fits into. As God forcibly scatters humanity over the whole face of the Earth, is that very moment when this window is opened for ideal climate in terms of human habitation. The window opens at that very moment that God is forcibly scattering humanity over the face of the earth. In terms of these land bridges, the land bridges that's most significant for us is the one that opened the way for the migration of human beings in North America. That bridge opened for the first time 13,500 years ago, and it closed at 10,800 years ago. So it was just about a 3,000-year wide window when human habitation was possible, or human migration from Siberia into Alaska was possible. The window opened for that migration, then it closed. But as the window was closing is when this stable climatic period was opening up. And so it's probably no accident that North America has been inhabited for only the last 11 or 12,000 years. Yes. Well, that's true. If you look at all these dates, probably something in the neighborhood of 30 to 35,000 years ago is a good mean date for God creating Adam and Eve. And yeah, that puts them right in the middle of, well, not the middle, puts them at the tail end of the Ice Age. But keep in mind that he was living in the region of Mesopotamia. Well, God gave him the command to spread out. I mean, he clearly did. And in fact, we're going to look at evidence that God was judging humanity for their failure to spread. I mean, the point about the pre-flood peoples, they didn't even get started. I mean, they just stayed right there in Mesopotamia. They never really got beyond that geography. And the Ice Age receding would have enabled them to move considerably beyond Mesopotamia, at least towards Australia and Africa. I mean, land bridges were available for migration into Australia 30,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago. So they could have done something. They might not have made it to North America, but or maybe to Finland, but they could have gone a lot of places, but they stayed put. And so we see in the 11th chapter of Genesis, is that God reacts very swiftly against the human goal of staying in one place. I mean, you can read, in fact, I'll read it to you. I mean, it's really quite blatant what the peoples of the world at that time say. Let me just jump ahead a little bit here. Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So here are the peoples of the world saying, we're not going to obey God's command to scatter and fill the earth. We're going to stay in one place, and we're going to build this city and this tower to maintain human unity, human peace, and togetherness. And God acts swiftly to prevent that. And what does it say in the 9th verse, 8th verse? So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. So this is when human unity was pushed down. And really the message we're going to look at about the flood, one of the messages is peace and unity, which is the goal of humanity ever since the beginning. I mean, how many of you have ever seen those bumper stickers, visualize world peace? Well, a message that we have in the Old Testament, the flood account, and Jesus made this quite clear when he was ministering here on earth. His purpose is not to bring about world peace and unity. Not until the peoples of the world first make their peace with God. If human beings are allowed to achieve peace and unity without making their peace with God, you're going to get a repeat of what happened in the days before the flood. That's the message. Peace and unity will work for evil, not for good. And when we get into the 11th chapter, we'll be discussing some of the political and economic dynamics which makes world peace and world unity very dangerous. You can kind of jump ahead by looking at this, but we can use a corporate model. what happens when a corporation gains a monopoly over a product? Do they lower the price, and do they increase the quality of the goods? Sometimes? Yeah, there are rare exceptions, all right? But what's the human tendency? Most corporations in human history, when they've gained a monopoly, what do? Raise the price, lower the quality, oppress the customer, all right? What happens when a nation becomes so dominant that they have no competition for their citizens or their corporations? They oppress the citizenry. How many times does that happen in human history? How many times do you see an exception? I mean, again, if you look at world history, I can think of a couple of exceptions where a dominant nation blessed their citizenry instead of oppressing them. But both of those examples, it was short-lived. You know, a few idealists got involved there at the beginning and said, let's do things right now that we got the power to do it right. When they were gone, when their generation died, so did the ideal. Oppression quickly followed. And so, anyway, I'm jumping ahead again. We got to stop doing that. All right. What we introduced last time was that if you really want people to live a long time, there's a lot of things you got to do. You got to have a vegetarian diet. You want to make sure you wear lots of sunscreen or wear a hat. Don't sunbathe. You want to protect yourself against carcinogens. You want to protect yourself from disease. But in terms of early human history, we were on a vegetarian diet until the ninth chapter of Genesis. And people probably didn't sunbathe like they do today. They wore clothes, and that's, you know, kind of what God got them doing there in the garden. They didn't have Dow Chemical to worry about, all right? And the early human population, being more genetically diverse, would have a little more protection from disease than what we would. You also want to protect yourself from accidents, but people are not driving Corvettes, so there might be a little more protection there. War and murder we'll identify as the prime contribution to limiting human population. We've already been through this, so I won't have to repeat it. But we look at what kept the human population down. Most people, by the way, did not live as long as the patriarchs. The average for the patriarchs was 912 years in the days before the flood. But very few got to enjoy that long lifespan because of the problem of murder. Murder was what kept the population down to such a low level. Okay, but 7 and 8 we identify as fundamental limitations in human lifespans that today would make 900-year lifespans impossible. And a lot of skeptics read the Bible and they say the Bible's preaching utter nonsense when it speaks about 900-year lifespans, because we know that's scientifically impossible. The basis of those comments are these two. But Genesis 6:3 tells us that God acted to shorten our lifespan. So I'm quite willing to say that God was the one that reprogrammed our cells. We have a programmed cell death today that makes human lifespan beyond 120 years impossible. Good thing, because that actually extends our lifespan. If we didn't have programmed cell death, we'd all be dying at age 20 or 30 or 40 at most. Because of programmed cell death, we get to live to be 70, 80, or 90. And what's ideal? A programmed cell death that kicks in about 120 years. Why do you need a programmed cell death of 120 years? Because of radiation. So what we're fingering is radiation may be the answer as to why it's impossible for us to live 900 years and why it was possible for people in the days before the flood to live those 900 years. If they had less radiation to deal with than we do, then there's no problem with them living 900 years. So on that basis, we could say we can dispel the charge that the Bible is preaching scientific nonsense if we can demonstrate that the peoples in the day before the flood were exposed to much less radiation than we are. And today we can do that. So I mentioned at the beginning of class last time, this particular paper by Wolfendale and Ehrlichman establishes that almost all of the deadly cosmic radiation comes from one supernova. When I was a graduate student in astronomy, they taught us that there were over 1,000 different supernova remnants that added up to 99% of all the cosmic radiation we face. And since these are distributed evenly throughout the galaxy, throughout the last several million years, then this means that the radiation bath on the surface of planet Earth has been a relative constant. But this paper dispels that conclusion by pointing out that, no, it comes from one supernova eruption. And interestingly, that one supernova eruption is the Vela supernova, which exploded in human history. And by the way, it's the most dramatic by far of all the supernova eruptions in human history. I mean, those of you who've been through high school, you were probably taught that the Crab Nebula was the big one, 1054 AD, so bright you could see it in the daytime. The Vela supernova was brighter than the full moon. So it was dramatic. The reason why you don't see in a lot of history books, it went off in the southern hemisphere. And since there weren't a lot of people writing history below the equator, you don't see a lot of it in the history books. But it was by far the most dramatic supernova in human history. 7 times closer to us than the Crab Nebula, which means the radiation we get from the Vela supernova is 49 times as intense as the radiation from the Crab Nebula. Yeah, hand there, Kathy. Yeah, I skipped over that because we've covered that so much in the past, but we do have guests here, so let me hit that again. Yeah, I am making the suggestion that this programmed cell death is tied in to radiation. You know, what I'm suggesting here is that if the Vela supernova is the radiation-enhancing event that made it impossible for human beings to live 900 years and couldn't live past a few decades, then it would be to God's advantage in terms of making it as pleasant as possible for human beings to reprogram our cell death. I'll put it up a little bit higher. Okay, apoptosis, which means programmed cell death. Supposing God did not reprogram our cell death cycle and left it at 1,000 years. I'm just guessing that in the days before the flood, God had the clock set at 1,000 years. Our cells would, terminate the human body in 1,000 years or less. If he left it there, then we wouldn't have the protection against cancers that we would have today. Okay, what does this programmed cell death really do? It prevents cells from replacing themselves too frequently. Now, I think you can understand why that would be an advantage to restraining cancer. Okay, now, more radiation means you've got a greater likelihood for cancer. And you don't want those cancerous cells just multiplying without control. And this apoptosis is one of the body's most effective tools for preventing the spread of cancerous tumors. And so if the clock, if the apoptosis clock were set at 1,000 years, we'd all be dying off at 20, 30, or 40. The fact that it's set at 120 means that cancer comes under greater control and we get to live 70, 80, or 90. Now, as you know, we know lots of people who die at 20, 30, and 40 from cancer still. And what's interesting is you look at those people that are dying relatively young from cancer. It's often because the radiation zaps the apoptosis, and the apoptosis doesn't work. In fact, that's been well documented in the literature. If the apoptosis is destroyed, then you have a much higher likelihood of early deaths from cancer. And often, and for some of the more virulent tumors, it's the destruction of the apoptosis that brings up the rapid death of the patient. Yes.
You mentioned the Vela.
Yes.
Now, I'm
No, because the radiation doesn't travel in a straight line. I mean, it does by the time it gets to us, but we have the solar magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field. The radiation gets well distributed over the whole planet. So you don't have any advantage living in Greenland compared to Australia. I mean, in Australia, you get a real good look, direct look at the Vela supernova, but the radiation's the same for the people in Greenland as it is in Australia. So, and by the way, that radiation persists for a long time. So it's not like we're any more exposed than people living 1,000 years ago or 1,000 years hence. So we're still being bathed by that radiation and will be for considerably more time. So, yeah, that's the suggestion I'm making, that you know, in reaction to the Vela supernova, and actually I wouldn't call it a reaction, I think God perfectly timed the Vela supernova to tie in with the spiritual lessons that he was trying to teach, but at the same time, he reprogrammed our cells, is kind of what you see in Genesis 6:3. Let me just read you again this particular passage where God says, "Then the Lord said, 'My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. Nothing in the text says how God's going to do it. But God certainly takes the credit for bringing your lifespan maximum down from 950 or 70 years down to a maximum of 120. Yes, Mike. How far north? I didn't catch the rest of it. Okay, what's the latitude of the Vela supernova? I'm guessing minus 40 degrees south in the atlas of the stars. So, yes. What's the date of the eruption of the Vela supernova? That's what we're going to get to. We've got a few minutes left. We're going to charge into how to calculate the date for the Vela supernova. All right. Thank you for anticipating that. Okay, this paper establishes that Vela's the culprit, all right? The first attempt to date the eruption of the Vela supernova was in this wonderful paper by Robert Breckenridge called Terrestrial Paleoenvironmental Effects of a Late Quaternary Age Supernova. I mean, again, it's one of these papers you all got to pick up and read. Just exciting reading. So, but what he did, and this was done back in 1981, so this is back in the dark ages of astronomy, okay? The Vela supernovas, all big supernova do, leave a pulsar behind. Okay, what happens in a supernova eruption? A star approximately, let's take a really big one like Vela was, say 50 times the mass of the sun. Okay, really big star. And very few stars are that big. Supernova happen about once every 100 years per galaxy. So these are relatively rare events. I mean, there's, what, 200 billion stars in our galaxy. That gives you an idea how rare it is. By the way, we're several hundred years overdue for a supernova eruption. The last one was like 350 years ago. So any time now. And astronomers are watching two stars they think are ready to go supernova any time. So you can check that out. What this guy does is I was going back to the supernova. One of these supergiant stars, what happens is the bigger the star, the faster it burns. A really big star will burn up all of its hydrogen fuel in maybe 80, 90,000 years. 100,000 years. 100,000 years, it consumes all of its hydrogen fuel. To put this in context, our sun will take 10 billion years to do the same thing. So the bigger the star, the faster it burns. Moreover, when the really big stars run out of hydrogen fuel, you've got this enormous star, and suddenly the nuclear furnace shuts off. Now, what governs the dynamics of a star is the radiation from the nuclear furnace causes the star to push out like this. You get radiation pressure trying to make the star bigger and bigger. gravity is trying to make it smaller and smaller. So when you turn off the nuclear switch, there's nothing to push the star out. Gravity, it's all that's left, and when it's as big as a star, 50 times star of the mass, you get a free fall gravitational collapse. What do I mean by free fall? Something that falls at this rate. Okay? Just falls right down to the center. And we're talking velocities of several hundred miles per hour of the outer surfaces of the sun moving down towards the core. And all this stuff is crashing down towards the car at these hypervelocities. What that does is send the pressure at the center of the star to a very high degree, to such a high degree that the temperature rises to over 100 billion degrees centigrade. When it gets that hot, it ignites something called the helium flash, and suddenly nuclear physics just goes crazy. And all this helium gets burnt up into silicon, sulfur, iron, and the final stages it makes uranium, mercury, silver, gold, all this thorium, all this neat stuff. And that particular reaction literally explodes a star in one final cataclysm. You say, well, how long are we talking? 7 months. So this helium flash takes place in a period of only a few months, exploding the star to smithereens, okay? And so most of the star gets blasted into outer space, and that's where all the deadly radiation comes from. That particular reaction just showers the environment with these gamma rays. Now then, as this gigantic explosion erupts into outer space, the core of the star gets squished by gravity even more. And so the very core of the star, which is about 10% of the whole mass of the star, gets catastrophically squished into either a black hole or a neutron star. And you're talking densities of 5 billion tons per teaspoonful. Okay? So put a teaspoonful in your coffee. It weighs 5 billion tons. All right? Get a picture of that. That's how dense. What's a neutron star? Well, it's 5 billion tons per teaspoonful, molecules will no longer exist. Atoms will no longer exist. Nuclei will no longer exist. The pressures are so intense that the protons and the neutrons in the atom get squished together to make neutrons. That's what a neutron is. It's basically a combination of a proton and an electron. And so in this neutron star, all the protons disappear. All the electrons disappear. They're all converted into neutrons. And so the star is a solid crystal of nothing but neutrons. The neutrons are all touching one another. And it's held in a solid crystal lattice. That's what a neutron star is. Now, this is important for dating the eruption of the Vela supernova. The fact that it's a solid neutron crystal lattice enables us to get a date for the Vela supernova and potentially a very accurate date for the Vela supernova. That's the last method I'm going to tell you about, okay? But the first attempt by Robert Breckinridge here was to do something relatively easy. He found the position of the Vela supernova pulsar, and then he was able to see all this ejecta flowing away from the pulsar. And that's the explosion. After all, the explosion only took place thousands of years ago, so the explosion of the star material is still visible flowing out from the star. Yes. A pulsar is a neutron star, right. It's a spinning neutron star. That's critical, too, the fact that it's spinning. And by the way, it's easy why it's spinning. Here's a star probably 200-300 million miles in diameter, all right? Big enough that it would, I mean, if our star were that big, the Earth's orbit would be inside the star, okay? So we would be vaporized by the heat of that star. That would also be true of Mars. Mars's orbit would be likewise inside the star's radius. Yeah, cool. I don't think so. I think it'd be pretty hot. But, thank you for the comments. I got to watch this with my sons. You know, they come along and say, you know, this is really bad, Dad. I said, well, if it's bad, get rid of it. What that means is it's really good. All right. I got lost again. Kat, you got to help me out. Yeah, back on this neutron, the pulsar. Yeah, it's okay. What happens when you shrink a radius of a slowly spinning body? Because a typical star rotates once every month. Okay, so stars are really slow rotators. But if you take something that's rotating once a month and you shrink it from hundreds of millions of miles in diameter down to the diameter of a pulsar, you know how big a pulsar is? 6 miles in diameter. That's how big it is. 6 miles in diameter containing probably five times the mass of our sun. All right? So our sun's a million miles in diameter. Take something five times more massive, shrink it down to 6 miles in diameter. So naturally, it's going to spin up a little bit. It's the ice skater effect. You know what an ice skater does and wants to spin fast? Well, put the legs and arms far apart like this and start a slow spin. And then they pull the legs together and the arms together like this, and they spin up rapidly. That's how they do those fast spins. If you really want to make it work well, put 220-pound weights in your and put weights on your ankles. Then come in like this, and you'll probably hurt yourself. You'll be spinning so fast, all right? In the case of one of these pulsars, when that collapse takes place, it will be spinning thousands of times per second. Thousands of times per second. Now then, because we're talking about a solid crystal lattice of neutrons spinning rapidly, you get, and it's spinning that fast, it will generate starquakes. Okay, and the starquakes will cause the pulsar to spin a little more slowly. So like the first pulsar that whose spin rate was the Crab Nebula, 33 times per second. Okay, most pulsars that we look at are spinning about once a second. But the Crab Nebula was the first rapid spinner that we saw. Vela spins much more rapidly than that. The fastest ones we observe are about 1,000. What astronomers would really like to do is to grab a brand new pulsar and measure its spin rate. Now, we got some theoretical calculations on how fast it should spin. And that's really where the uncertainties lie. I'm jumping ahead of myself. I'm talking about the most accurate measurement, and it's this one here, called Very Low Breaking Index for the Vela Pulsar. And so, as astronomers have been measuring the spin down of these pulsars, they measure the rate at which it spins down. And they can measure the rate at which it's spinning down and its current spin rate, they can calculate when it first erupted. And that's what these British astronomers are doing in this paper. They're measuring the rate at which it's spinning down and calculating or measuring what the spin rate today is, and knowing what the spin rate was when it first formed, then they can calculate when the Vela supernova erupted. Now then, the problem is that the starquake physics, by the way, earthquake research, JPL is very involved in the earthquake research, as many of you know, and it's difficult because the crystal structure of the Earth is very complicated. You know, there's all kinds of different elements and molecules that make up the Earth's crust, and there's different things that will crack the crust. I mean, life here in California is great because we lived in a place that's a highly fissured. And so we get earthquakes. They only can do damage over a relatively small distance. Whereas back east, the structure is much more stable, fewer cracks. And so when the Missouri quake erupted, it rang church bells in Boston and all down the coast of the Atlantic, all the way down to Georgia, these church bells were rung. That can't happen here in California. Of course, you get more quakes, but anyways. But with a solid crystal lattice of neutrons, you've got far simpler physics. And so it's possible, as these gentlemen point out, as these four authors point out, to get a more accurate prediction of when these star quakes will occur. and what they will do to cause the pulsar to spin down. They've seen quite a few star quakes, and they see how to adjust the spin rate. Okay, what's the bottom line from these guys? They date the eruption of the Vela supernova at 22 to 29,000 years ago. That's what they get from this. Now then, what they point out in their paper with better modeling of this solid crystal lattice and a little more measurements of the spin-down rate of the Vela supernova, because what we notice in all pulsars is that they're spinning down as a result of these star quakes. And the rate of spin down isn't exactly linear. These gentlemen were assuming that there was a small departure from linearity. We're just at the point where we can measure how much the rate of spin down changes with respect to time. The good news about this paper is within another 10 years, we should be able to get a far more accurate date for the eruption of the Vela supernova. Okay? That's a British study. Now, let me tell you about two German studies. But to pave the way for the German studies, back to Robert Breckinridge. What he did was he saw, well, here's the Vela supernova, and here's all the stuff flowing away from the Vela pulsar. All I'm going to do is measure the positions of all the pieces of debris that I can find and see how fast they're going. Right. So he measures the velocity of how fast these pieces of debris are moving away from the pulsar. And he took all the different pieces of debris. I think he measured about 50 different pieces, took a mean average, and he got a date of 8,500 to 14,000 years ago, the Vela supernova erupted. Yes. Pardon me? Well, yeah, some of the pieces will be moving a little bit faster than other pieces. So, yeah, what you do is you measure as many pieces as you can find, measure the distances back to the pulsar as accurately as you can, and take a global average. That explains why he got a date range from 8,500 to 14,000 years ago. Now, just last year, two different groups of German astronomers said, now, wait a minute. The one thing Robert Breckinridge did not take into account is that this supernova is only 1,300 light years away. It's the closest of all the supernovae that have occurred in human history, by far. Something that close will have significant proper motion. I mean, all the stars are moving relative to other stars. And, you know, astronomers can look at the nearest stars and notice that they tend to move a little bit along the line of sight. You know, they move this way. They also move this way. This way is called radial motion. This way is called proper motion. And it's the proper motion that's going to generate significant errors in Breckinridge's study, because what he was doing is he took the Vela supernova pulsar, saw it in the sky, he assumed it had moved. Then he measures the ejecta flowing out from that position. The Germans come along and say, who's to say that position's right? What we need is the position of that pulsar when it first erupted. And to do that, we have to carefully measure its proper motion. It's hard to do, especially if you only got observations over the past 50 years. But they went ahead and did it, and they came up with two different results, two different German teams. Made these measurements. Group 1 says it's 31,000 plus or minus 6,000 years ago. Group 2 says 18,000 plus or minus 9,000 years ago. Who's right? Who's wrong? Makes a big difference. And here are the Brits right in the middle, 22 to 29,000 years ago. Okay, this as of right now is not resolved. Now, when you look at the second German study, 31,000 plus or minus 6,000 years ago, hey, that's a more accurate result. But you know what? What both are not able to discern at this point is what's disturbing the proper motion with respect to time. Is that constant over time or does it vary over time? That needs to be resolved. How do you resolve that? Watch it for another 10 or 20 years. Then you'll be able to figure it out. Good news is, if you're still with this class 10 years from now, we should be able to give you a really accurate date for the eruption of the Vela supernova. Now, by then, we should be in, what, Genesis chapter 10? Yes. No, that would be the date that the radiation and the light reached the Earth. It happened 1,300 years earlier than that. But, yeah, astronomers always correct for the light travel time. So that did get corrected in that case. Yes. No, I haven't read that. Sorry, but... Tom's got a copy of that article. He's going to give it to me after class, so I guess I will get a chance to read it next week. All right. I'll be here next week. Yeah, well, all three of these studies, Robert Breckinridge, the American, the four Brits, and the two sets of three Germans tried to do, is buttress their conclusion with some evidence for extinction. I mean, if you get all this radiation showing up in the Earth all at the all at once, that should yield some extinction events, particularly of plankton. The point is this, is that you not only get a lot of cosmic radiation from a supernova, you get a lot of ultraviolet radiation from supernova. Now, the ultraviolet radiation goes away quite quickly. The cosmic radiation sticks around to do us harm for thousands and thousands of years. The ultraviolet radiation only sticks around for tens of years. Okay, but that should have a significant impact, especially on phytoplankton. You know, those plankton that sit right at the top of the ocean, they should be quite subject to this. What's confusing about all of this is all three of these different research teams are able to say, hey, look at this phytoplankton that went extinct just at the time that my date calculates. Well, what's going on here is that ultraviolet radiation fluctuates quite a bit anyway because of the ozone shield fluctuating. And so I'm skeptical at this point whether we have any documentation showing extinctions. And one of the problems here is here's God reprogramming our cell death. He probably did some other reprogramming as well. Text doesn't say. But if he began reprogramming cell death in lots of other animals, then this might mitigate some of these extinction events. But I do agree, phytoplankton will be an excellent place to look for that ultraviolet pulse. But unfortunately, there are lots of ultraviolet events that lead to that because those species are so sensitive. What you really need to find is a species that's not as sensitive as phytoplankton to ultraviolet extinction. I don't know of such species. Maybe some of the biologists in the class here can help me out. But all these people have done is look at phytoplankton, which is probably the wrong thing to look at. Hey, there goes the bell. We've covered all this. We can move on next week to Genesis 6:2 and 6:4. Yes. Yeah, there has been some recent work on how certain frog populations are dropping worldwide and what that could be pinned to. So I've seen conflicting reports on what's to blame. But, yeah, there are things going on. I mean, after all, our ultraviolet radiation is going up right now very significantly. So the ozone shields. Yeah, the cosmic radiation is gamma radiation, essentially. Yeah, now you can see why that ties into cancer and other things. That's the really nasty stuff. And by the way, there's no escape from that radiation. Now, there is an escape, but it's not a good escape. As I mentioned last week, if you build a house with lead walls that are 13 inches thick, you'll be adequately protected from cosmic radiation. But that's not a practical thing for any of us to do. As I mentioned, even if you were to be successful, one of the problems with lead is all lead is contaminated with uranium. That's where lead comes from, after all. All the lead that we have in the universe is a decay product of uranium. And so when you find a nice deposit of lead, there's going to be a little bit of uranium mixed in there. That's more deadly than the cosmic radiation. So your only other alternative is to live underground. But you've got to live a long ways underground. That makes life, the quality of life, a little bit unpleasant. And by the way, living underground's got its own risks. The deeper you go underground, the more exposure you get to thorium and uranium decay. And so coal miners, for example, don't live as long as the rest of the human population because of the extra exposure to radiation. They don't die from cosmic rays. They die from radioactive decay products in the Earth's crust. So bottom line is there's really no way out, but it also ties into where the first human beings were. They must have been in a place that was relatively remote from granite and igneous exposures. Mesopotamia floodplain, especially towards the south, excellent candidate. Hey, let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had going through some of these new scientific evidences that really heightens our confidence that the opening chapters of Genesis indeed are the error-free word of God. Thank you for the privilege of being alive at the end of the 20th century when so much of this research is taking place. Lord, I pray that we would go beyond just the joy of seeing these very strong proofs for the reliability of the Bible to sharing them with other people. Father, we live in a day and an age where there's a lot of skepticism, where people need some really strong reasons to believe. And Father, help us to effectively communicate these new discoveries in a way that would encourage people to study and read your Bible, realizing that it indeed is your word to them. And Father, may your light penetrate the hearts of these people into salvation. Help us to do this in a gentle, respectful way with a clear conscience. In Jesus' name, amen.